members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. Every nation has its great leaders, the movers and shakers of government and society. In the United States, there are two such men we revere and honor every February on President's Day, which commemorates their respective birth dates. They are George Washington, whom we call the father of our nation, and the first president, who set the standard by which all succeeding presidents could govern the Union, and Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States, who came into his presidency exactly when that Union of States was being torn apart. It is Mr. Lincoln's life and legacy we want to focus on today. To do this, we have with us Mr. Ron Anderson, founder and president of the Lincoln Leadership Society, and author of the book, Abraham Lincoln, God's Humble Instrument. Ron, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Marilee. It's a pleasure to be here.
We appreciate you coming. To get started, could you explain to us how you got involved in the life of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, it wasn't intended. It was about 7 years ago I picked up a book on Abraham Lincoln, and it happened to be about his speeches. And I was struck with the numerous references to God which he made in those speeches. And so after I read that book, I picked up another one. I started making notes. I had no intention of writing a book, but as the notes and thoughts and ideas kept coming, I started organizing them and then decided to go ahead and put it together. To make a long story short, the publisher I approached was willing to accept it, and it came out just before the Abraham Lincoln bicentennial, 2 years ago, when we as a nation commemorated the 200 years of Lincoln being born. And now we're coming into the 150-year sesquicentennial of a number of important events in the life of Abraham Lincoln, his becoming president. This March 4th will commemorate the sesquicentennial, him becoming our president. And in April, we'll commemorate the 150-year anniversary, unfortunately, of the horrible Civil War.
To understand President Lincoln, what events and ideas in his youth and in his younger life shaped his character, do you think, the person that he would become?
Well, right off the bat, that's got to be his mother. Nancy Lincoln died when Abraham Lincoln was 9 years old. And the story goes that that she called him to her bedside, him and his sister Sarah, the only two siblings in the Lincoln family, and asked Abraham Lincoln to be kind to everyone in the world and just to be a good boy. Lincoln always remembered that charge from his mother. In fact, there's also a story that later on that his Lincoln told a man that his mother asked him to never smoke or drink. And Lincoln never did smoke or drink or gamble. And he told one person who was trying to offer him a drink in his later life, he says, well, maybe this is a time to break my mother's promise. And he told him the story. And the man said, oh, no, I don't want you to break your mother's promise. And he never did. I don't want to get off on a tangent, but when Lincoln became president, a delegation from the Chicago Convention came to his home. And he and Mary, his wife, had an argument. Because Mary said, this is such a special event, you've got to have an appropriate beverage to serve these distinguished guests. And she meant some kind of brandy or alcoholic beverage. And Lincoln considered it, but in the end, he did not serve alcohol. He wouldn't let Mary go purchase any. And so when they came, she came out with a pitcher and cups of water, and he told them that we don't drink in my house, so you're getting a drink of Adam's ale. But his mother was a factor, and a year later, when his father came to meet Sarah Bush Johnston, she was a widow, and she came into Lincoln's life with the three children, which is a remarkable thing. We can all know how difficult that is to blend families, and for a woman to come in and take the place of a young boy's mother. Sarah Bush Johnston was remarkable. in the way that he loved her and she loved him. And she made the comment that he never lied to her. He never dodged. He always did everything that she asked him to do. And she said, he never gave me a crossword, nor did I ever have to give him a crossword. His mother's, Nancy, his angel mother, which Sarah said, she'll be your angel mother and I will be your fill-in mother. They were probably the greatest influence in his life.
Now, he was born in Kentucky?
Kentucky.
And where were all the places that he lived?
He was only in Kentucky a short time, and then his family moved to Indiana because his father was anti-slavery. Most of the people in the country, particularly in Kentucky, were pro-slavery, and they say that was one of the reasons he wanted to leave Kentucky. He moved to Indiana, southern Indiana, and that's where Lincoln grew up as a boy until in his late teens they moved to southern Illinois. And that's where Lincoln lived all the rest of his life until he went to Washington.
So what were the kind of circumstances that he lived in?
Oh, extreme poverty. The first home that they lived in the wilderness, it was a three-sided building, and there was a fourth side open. They just lit a fire in the front of that open side. There's a term for that building, and I don't recall what they call it. But that was the first year that he lived, and there were bears and mountain lions, and he talked about how fearful it was at night because they could hear the wolves and the animals, and there's open – it had a shelter, but there was a fourth wall open, and the only thing protecting them was the fire. His father was never wealthy. He struggled to make a good living, but he was a good man, and so Lincoln lived in poverty. He knew poverty very well.
And he knew hard work.
And he knew hard work. He did work very hard. Speaking of work, he did not like farming, and he didn't want to become a farmer or anyone in that. He was always reading books, and his stepmother said he was always reading anything to get his hands on. But he would take books to the field, and when there would be a break, he would immediately find some shade, lay on the ground and prop his feet up on a tree and read. And there was one time when his father lent him out to work for another farmer. And so this farmer noticed that Lincoln was always wanting to read, and he made the comment, "You're not very much for this work, are you?" And Lincoln looked at him. Lincoln was about 16 at the time. And he said, "Well, my pa taught me how to work, but he never taught me how to like it." Lincoln and his father used to spend the evenings. Obviously, they don't have the entertainment we do. They would spend their nights telling stories. His father was really good at it. Lincoln got to be extremely good at it. And through his life, he was known as a storyteller. He would tell stories to make a point. And he used the example of Jesus because he was very well read in the Bible, how Jesus taught in parables. Lincoln was always linking a concept to some kind of a story, all through his presidency, all in the years up until his presidency. Many of them are very comical, and at nighttime people would gather him around to say, "Lincoln, stand up and tell us some stories." And he would do that into the night, and all of his friends would be drinking and gambling, and he'd be the life of the party but would never drink.
That's fun. That's fun. The last place he lived was Illinois, and like you talk, he read all the time. He didn't have much of a formal education, did he?
They say he had a total in different periods of his life of about 1 year of formal education.
And yet eventually he was able to get his lawyer's license.
That's correct.
How did he do that?
Now that is an interesting story. He loved law. He was very interested in that. He would walk 15 miles as a boy just to sit in the nearest courtroom and just observe. But he dreamed of going to college, and he knew that there would be no way he could go to college. You needed to know someone of influence or be someone of influence to do that, and that was not in any of that in his life. But he bought a store as a young man, and so he had sold groceries and other things out of the store. And here's the interesting story. A stranger drives through this little town called New Salem, Illinois. There were only about 200 or 300 people in the little town, and bought some goods in his store. And when the man goes out to his wagon, he was heading west. He was a settler heading west. When he gets to his wagon, he doesn't have room for the goods. So he pulls off this barrel, sets it down in front of Abe Lincoln. Lincoln's about 20, in his early 20s. And he says, "I don't have room. Would you buy this barrel?" And Lincoln looks in it, and it's just junk. And he looks at it and he says, there's nothing here that I really need. But Lincoln was such a kind and charitable individual, he bought it anyway. He bought the barrel of junk, and it sat in his store for several days until finally he started going through it. And at the bottom of the barrel were a set of books called Blackstone's Commentaries, and these were the very books that are used in American law schools, right, given right to him. And so for the next several months, people would see Lincoln laying on the ground, feet propped up against a tree, and he'd move with the shade of the tree. He'd move around studying those books, and he taught himself law.
Wow.
Got his law degree and law license.
That's amazing. I know he moved to Springfield, where he began to set up his practice and where he started working in law. What was Illinois like at that time? This is the 1830s, right?
That's correct. In Illinois and Springfield, there were like 2,000 people. It was the capital of Illinois. And Lincoln, at age 25, was elected to be the House of Representatives. And so he spent a lot of time there in Springfield. He was living in New Salem at the time and then eventually moved to Springfield. Illinois is a northern state, but most of the people were Democrats. The other party at the time were Whigs, and the Whigs became the Republican Party two decades later. Most of the people in Illinois were pro-slavery, and in the early 30s, that was a big political issue, and it just escalated over the next two, three decades to culminating in the Civil War. So he was very much a minority. He was a Whig, House of Representatives, and it was just a typical Western kind of country town.
This is also the same time as the organization of the church. Did
yes.
Lincoln ever cross paths with Mormonism?
Yes, he did. In fact, I'm writing a second book all about Lincoln's interactions with the Mormons. It's going to be called The Early Mormons Through Lincoln's Eyes. But while the saints were coming across, this is in the early 1831, Joseph Smith gets a revelation that he and others should go to the border state of Missouri, which is Independence. And some of those actually went through Springfield, Illinois. And it's in the newspaper in the Springfield, Illinois, that about 100 of them passed through. Well, it was only about 28 that God called in the Doctrine and Covenants, about 28 that went. But in the newspaper articles, everything seemed to be
bigger,
escalated and not accurate. But in those years, Abraham Lincoln in Springfield, Illinois, they've identified 137 articles about the Mormons in his local Springfield newspaper. Lincoln was a voracious reader of newspaper and public events. He would have read at least the vast majority of those articles. So he knew what was going on with the saints being driven the first time up to Clay County. He knew when they were driven up to Far West. He knew, obviously, when they were driven to Illinois, because at the time when they came to Illinois in 1839, he was in the state legislature. It was a very big political issue for them to have one estimate is 8,000 Mormons, and Joseph Smith's estimate was 15,000 Mormons coming across into Illinois. The fortunate thing
and the capital is only 2,000 people.
That's right. And so Nauvoo, in just a short amount of time, became, some say, the largest city, or at least as large as Chicago, in just a very short amount of time. This is a huge political issue, and Abraham Lincoln was very involved in that, because Mormons tend to vote in a block. So it was a big issue. Who were they going to vote for, the Whig candidates or the Democratic candidates? So Lincoln was very, very involved in that.
Looking at the life of Abraham Lincoln, and then I'm also looking at the life of Joseph Smith, and I see some similarities. Do you see any similarities?
There are a lot of similarities, which is very interesting to me. Let's talk political similarities. Joseph Smith, as we know, became a candidate for president in 1843, just about a year before he died. And that infuriated the folks in Illinois to the point that it eventually led to his assassination, that and other events. But he prepared a political pamphlet, and he listed the political tenets that he stood for. Then you take Abraham Lincoln, who becomes a presidential candidate 15 years later, and you compare those two, and they are nearly identical. It's really an interesting study to see how closely Lincoln's politics – were to Joseph Smith's politics two decades earlier.
Well, and not only that, you just even look at the circumstances in which they were raised.
That's correct.
The American frontier.
Poverty, no formal education. Joseph Smith became one of the more influential leaders in our history, and so did Abraham Lincoln.
So I just thought that was interesting when you put the two men side by side.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. I don't know how much detail we want to get into here, but one thing that's very interesting to me was Abraham Lincoln never joined any church. He didn't belong to any church. And back then, if you didn't join a church, you were an infidel. That's the term they used. And that's about as bad as a name as you could call anyone. It was a political liability for Abraham Lincoln. He would not join. And the reason he would not join is because he believed that the Protestant churches were interpreting the Bible incorrectly. And when you look at the reasons, and we have, I have quotes of what he believed. And one of the problems he held with the Protestant religions was that he believed that all men could be saved. And the Protestant religions did not. They believed that only those that would, for various things, would come to God, only those would be saved. And Lincoln believed that the time would come that all would be saved. He called it universal salvation. He didn't believe in eternal punishment, or eternal damnation was the term that he used. He thought that men would be punished for their sins, but not forever and ever and ever, only for a time. And again, that's very similar to Latter-day Saint doctrine. One more I'll just add to you, and that is he didn't believe that men are punished for Adam's transgression. And all Protestant churches did, but the Latter-day Saint religion believes that men are punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression.
Thank you for listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. Our guest today is Ron Anderson, and we are discussing the life and legacy of U.S. President Abraham Lincoln. A little earlier, we talked about how Abraham Lincoln was really well-liked. He was an incredible storyteller. He could be the life of the party. What were his weaknesses? How did he view himself?
That's an interesting thing. He was a very humble individual, very charitable individual. And there are, in my study of Lincoln, there are a few, very, very few liabilities in his demeanor and his character. There were a few times, a couple in his early life, where he kind of stepped over the line just with some fun articles that he put in the newspaper that were kind of criticizing another individual. But other than that, he was very charitable, very forgiving. One of the things that interests me as much as anything with Lincoln is the way that he lived his life and how it is so close to Jesus's teaching of the Sermon on the Mount about turning the other cheek and forgiving them who might be forgiven and going the extra mile and doing good to those that hate us and such. Lincoln was that way from a boy all the way up through his life and on through the presidency. He was a humble individual. He was often accused of being suffering from depression because he would go into what they called melancholy. Well, he had a lot of reason to grieve. His mother died when he was 9. His sister died a few years after that. He fell in love with a beautiful young woman named Nancy Rutledge, and before they could be married, they were engaged. She got an illness. They call it typhoid or typhus. I'm not sure. But she died before they could be married. So he knew grief, and there were many times he would grieve, and there are books written about suggesting that Lincoln suffered from depression. I don't share that belief because I'm not a clinical psychologist, but Lincoln could pull himself out of these moments of melancholy. And he'd often do it with humor, with the stories that he'd tell. And he could go to this deep, pensive attitude where his law partner would say he would sit down and look out the window in his law office and for 2 hours not move a muscle, just stare out the window. The other thing I think it is when we see those, it might be melancholy, but he was a deep, deep thinker. And oftentimes, those times of melancholy, he was just thinking through thoughts, and he would essentially tune out everyone else who was around him. And they called it his moments of melancholy. I think there were some times where he was sad, but other times I think he was just thinking.
Just a deep, deep thinker.
Yes. Now, can I share something also about
this
new? He had premonitions of greatness. There's two I'd like to share. When he's 17 years old, the first time he ever worked outside of his little home, he got a chance to take a flatboat on the Ohio River down to the Mississippi River to New Orleans. He's 17 years old. And when he gets there, he delivers the goods, and he witnesses his first slave auction, which were going on in America, had been part of America for over 200 years. And he watched how this mother was sold to one plantation owner and a father to another, and the brothers and sisters all parceled out, never to see each other again. He saw the tears and the anguish, and he looked over at his partner and he said, "If I ever get a chance to hit this thing," referring to slavery, "I'm going to hit it hard." Now, that's a 17-year-old boy, idealistic. You're thinking, okay, maybe a lot of young men thought that. But it was Abraham Lincoln who did abolish slavery. Now, advance 2 decades later, he's in his, I believe it's around his mid to late 30s. And he's going back to, back then, the entertainment was itinerant speakers. And there was a doctor, Peter Akers, I believe he was a Methodist minister. I could be wrong, but he was a Protestant minister coming to speak in a nearby town. Well, Lincoln is a lawyer, and a few of his lawyer friends get into a wagon, and they drive to this town to listen to Dr. Peter Akers, who was going to speak against slavery. So most of the people in Illinois in that audience were pro-slavery. So it got pretty heated, and those audiences would let you know if they didn't agree.
Oh, yeah. They could be quite vocal, and they could throw things, too.
That's exactly right. And that was that's what was going on here. As they were driving in the wagon to this speech, it was a couple hours or more to get there, Abraham Lincoln, once again, is the life of the party. He's telling his stories and telling his jokes, and they're just laughing and enjoying the ride. Dr. Peter Akers, and this is in 1837, he says three things that are very significant. He says, the only way we're going to get rid of slavery is through a civil war. Well, everyone thought that was just absolutely crazy, but it turned out to be right. Then he said, I believe that civil war is going to take place somewhere in the 1860s. And the Civil War started in 1861. We'll commemorate the sesquicentennial of that in April. By this time, the crowd is in an uproar and ready to pull him off the stage. And at the top of his voice, he says this. He says, and who can tell but that that man who will lead us through this crisis is not standing in this presence. Those are exact words. Abraham Lincoln is 30 feet away. And in fact, Lincoln was the man who led us through that crisis. On the way home, they're talking about the speech and such, and Abraham Lincoln doesn't say a word. He's silent. He's in one of his pensive modes. So his friends finally asked him and said, Abe, what did you think of Dr. Akers' speech? And he was very solemn. And I can't paraphrase. I have to paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, the quote. But he essentially said, I believe his words came from God. They weren't by mortal man. And he says, I'm convinced that slavery will come down with the crash of a civil war. And then he paused for a moment. And he says, and you're going to think this is strange, but he said, I can't get it out of my mind that I'm going to play a significant part in that terrible crisis. And then the next morning, they got home late, and he comes into work, and his senior law partner is there, and some people have been asking for Abe, for Mr. Lincoln. And immediately his law partner says, my goodness, Abe, what's wrong with you? Because Abe didn't sleep that night. And he recounted the same story and told his law partner, he says, I can't get it out of my mind that I will be a significant player in that crisis. And it did. I mean, that's exactly where Lincoln ended up. So he did have premonitions of his greatness. And I believe that some of those moments of melancholy were him pondering what lay ahead for him.
At the age of 33, he married Mary Todd. Who was she? Tell us a little bit about her.
Now, that's an interesting story, too. She was from Kentucky, from a slave owner's family, quite wealthy, and much more educated than young women at the time. Lincoln really liked that about Mary Todd. She moved because she had a sister in Springfield, Illinois, and she was essentially the belle of the town. Every eligible suitor had their eye on Mary Todd. She used to tell her girlfriends, and did this numerous times, that the man that she married would be president of the United States. And the two men that were the most serious suitors for her hand were Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas. Now, Stephen A. Douglas was that great U.S. senator. Those two started their political careers at the same place at the same day. Stephen A. Douglas was just a couple years younger than Abraham Lincoln. So Mary had a choice of the two men that were courting her would be the presidential candidates of 1860. And she chose correctly. She chose Abraham Lincoln, who did become president. Even after she married Lincoln, she would often say, "My husband will become president of the United States." And she was right. She was a little different personality than Abraham Lincoln, a little more fiery. So one story about Mary Lincoln, which I really like, kind of describes her personality. She went to the market and bought some produce. And when she came home, some of the produce at the bottom was bad. Well, that made her angry. Now, Lincoln, he would have just thought, "Oh, that's okay." But not her. She went back to the merchant and she laid into him, really let him have a piece of her mind as to why he would sell her bad produce. A few days pass and Lincoln runs into the merchant, and the merchant tells his story of how Mary really lit into him. And Lincoln listens very patiently. And when he was through, he was very tall. He put his hand on his shoulder and threw a short man, very much shorter than him. And he says, "Oh, now, you'll be all right. You just endured for 15 minutes what I've been enduring for 15 years. But Mary, he did appreciate her interest in politics. She was very involved with it. At times, she was an outstanding first lady, and other times, she was an embarrassment to Lincoln and to the country. Some of the things, I'll just say one thing about that. It was kind of unfortunate. She really got caught up in appearances, and she spent at that time over $20,000, which President Lincoln didn't know about, on material for dresses and for drapes and things. And I must say that the prior president, James Buchanan, the White House was pretty run down, and she did a lot to fix it up. But it was well over her budget, and when they finally found out, Lincoln found out long after she'd spent it. That's the only time that I heard him swear, that I have a record of him swearing. He said, "You know, these our soldiers are out there, they're freezing and they're starving, and you're spending this money on your damned flub-dubs." That was his response, and Congress had to hold a special session to find money to cover her expenses. But he loved his wife, and she loved him. They had a beautiful, beautiful last day of his life. We'll probably get to that a little later, but I'll share that.
Now, they eventually had four sons.
Yes.
What happened to those boys?
They lost two of those boys when they were boys. Again, adding to Abraham Lincoln's grief, he certainly knew grief and sadness. But while they're in Springfield, Illinois, their second son, Edward, 3 years old, almost 4 years old, he got sick and he died. And that was very tragic for them. And later that year, she became pregnant and they had their third son, Willie. And Willie went with them. They had two more boys and Tad was the youngest. They took those two boys to Washington when they became president. The oldest boy was going to Harvard. But while they're in Washington, that first year in office, Willie got sick, and he died. They were both sick, both the boys, and they literally lost both of them. Willie was a boy that he was 11 years old when he died. He was very much like his father. It looked like he had qualities like his father. They loved all their boys very much, but to lose Willie just tore their hearts. And Mary was so grief-stricken, she couldn't even attend the funeral for her son. It was a tragically sad moment, as anyone who's lost a child would know. But Lincoln used that to remind himself the grief of the hundreds of thousands of mothers and fathers and wives and children whose fathers and brothers and sons never came home. He knew that grief, and he felt it very, very personally through the loss of Willie and Edward.
You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. We're discussing the life of Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States, with Ron Anderson. I think now we can finally move into the presidency. Mr. Lincoln's rise to the presidency was actually quite unexpected. How did it come about?
That is a very interesting element of his life. Let me just say this. Lincoln was elected 11 years before he became president of the United States to Congress. And he promised his constituents he'd only run for one session or one
term?
One term. And he did. He wanted to stay, and he could have been reelected, but he didn't because he made that promise. And then he supported a friend who had supported him. So it was 11 years between him being in Congress and then him becoming president of the United States, and there was no political office whatsoever in that time. So the thought of him becoming president is so unlikely. But it started after he came home and being in Congress. He decided to essentially retire from politics, and he just focused on his law practice until 1854, 5 years later, when Stephen A. Douglas, who used to be his friend, I mean, they were close friends, who's now at the pinnacle of his political career back in Congress, he pushes through this Kansas-Nebraska Act, which was this big battleground of these were territories, and the battle was, are they going to be slave territories or free soil territories? It was a huge battle, and Stephen A. Douglas won the battle to make a compromise, which he called it, popular sovereignty, where he says, let's not let Congress decide, let's let the people decide. And so by the vote of the people, they could vote to see if they would be slave or free. Lincoln, when he saw that happen, he thought that was the beginning of the end for the nation. And when you look at the circumstances, there are many of us, and I'm certainly one that feels that Abraham Lincoln was absolutely right. For one thing, and Lincoln said this, he says, you've turned the issue of slavery from a moral issue to just a public issue. You've removed the immorality of slavery with this bill. And he says, it is going to divide and destroy the nation if nothing is done. So he decides to take on Stephen A. Douglas. You've got to understand, Stephen A. Douglas got it passed in Congress. The president, Franklin Pierce, signed it into law, and the Supreme Court supported it. In fact, just three years later, they passed the Dred Scott decision, which said that a black man is a being of inferior order. They have no right to vote or to take any man to court. And the hundreds of thousands of women that were raped black women that were raped by their masters had no legal recourse whatsoever. That was America, and Congress, the president, and the Supreme Court all supported it. And Lincoln knew that was wrong, and amazingly, he takes them on. It's a six-year process. But when Stephen A. Douglas passed this popular sovereignty, it angered some of his own supporters. So he goes back to Illinois and goes traveling around these little towns to buoy them up and get their support. Lincoln approaches him, and again, Lincoln, he's just an old country lawyer. He's no politician. He goes to Stephen A. Douglas and says, let's debate this issue. Well, Stephen A. Douglas says no. Why? And the question is, why would he debate Lincoln? He said he had already debated the strongest Republicans in Congress and won. One author said he had already mopped the floor with the Republicans in Congress. Why would he want to debate a country lawyer? So he refused. But Lincoln wouldn't give up. And so as Stephen A. Douglas would go from town to town, Lincoln walked away from his practice and followed him and would listen. Wouldn't say anything because he honored Lincoln's desire that they not debate. But at one of those places, someone stood up and says, let's hear Abraham Lincoln's view of this. Lincoln says, we've already agreed that we won't debate. But he said, but I will talk about this tomorrow. And the place was packed again the next day, and Lincoln gave the other side of it. And he continued to follow Stephen A. Douglas around doing the same thing. He was criticized for it. One newspaper, a pro-Stephen A. Douglas paper, said Lincoln can't get his own audience, so he's living off of Stephen A. Douglas's. But the point is, Stephen A. Douglas, the most powerful politician in America, anything he said was in the newspapers all over the country. And now this country bumpkin lawyer is speaking against it. And so his words started being printed in the local papers and then out all over the country. And Lincoln did this for 4 years until they're now debating to be Senate, to run for Senate. And now they're debating against each other. Everyone's getting to know Abraham Lincoln through these famous debates. Stephen A. Douglas wins that election, but Lincoln, they run again for president. And we all know who won in 1860. It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. His speeches were so powerful. There was a speech given in Bloomington, Illinois around 1855 when he became the Illinois Republican candidate for the Senate. That's what it was, to run against Stephen A. Douglas. I probably have the dates wrong. But it was a packed house. There were 40 newspaper reporters in that room. And it was such a powerful message, not one of them wrote it down. They were there to write the speech. That was their job. They'd written every other speech. They were so enthralled by the speech, including Lincoln's law partner who was there doing the same thing. He says, I put pen and paper down, and I was just caught up in the moment like everyone else.
They forgot to write.
They forgot to write the speech. And so it was Lincoln's powerful speeches that got him this notoriety and to the point to where he would actually win the election in 1860, become our president.
Now, my understanding is that he actually won the presidency with only 39% of the vote, which is quite low. How did he do that? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, that's a very significant point as well, because there were some in the South, they called them the fire eaters. Those were the rich, aristocratic slave owners in the South that were pushing for secession.
So they were doing this already. This push for secession was coming.
It had been going since the early 1830s, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. South Carolina, back when Andrew Jackson was president, wanted to secede. And he says, you try it and I'll have 40,000 troops on South Carolina soil. So they'd been talking for a long time, but it was really becoming a strong movement. And the South became convinced that there had to be some kind of crisis and needed to create a crisis. And this is how Lincoln won the election. Stephen A. Douglas, a Democrat, and Abraham Lincoln, a Republican. The Republican Party was a new party. He was our first Republican president. By far, Stephen A. Douglas was the favorite. Until in the Democratic Convention in 1860 in South Carolina, the South split in half. And they did this intentionally. They said, they told Stephen A. Douglas, you got to go on the platform that slavery will end right now. And Stephen A. Douglas says, that's ridiculous. We can't do that. We need to work toward this. And he says, if you don't, we're going to go for another candidate, Breckinridge. And so all of the Southern Democrats went with Breckinridge. The Northern Democrats stayed with Stephen A. Douglas. And with that split, that's how the dark horse, Abraham Lincoln, was elected with 39% of the vote. It was so unlikely, but some of those in the South calculated this is exactly what they wanted, because with the Republican president, they said, this will never do. Lincoln was essentially the first real anti-slavery president, which is amazing, too. Most of our presidents were either soft on slavery or pro-slavery. And so they say, this is a crisis now. When he's elected, they said, when he's elected, we in South Carolina are going to secede, exactly as it says in D&C 87, in that prophecy. And then they sent out emissaries to all the other southern states. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And when it happened, we've done it. Now you follow. And they did. Seven states seceded at first, and then four more followed.
So by the time President Lincoln approaches his inauguration, he's already got a
divided nation.
Divided.
It was
nation.
A crisis. It was the absolute worst crisis in America. And all of this happened. This crisis took place. He was elected in November and took office in March. There's that space of time. That's when the secessions took place. So when he's inaugurated March 4th, 1861, 150 years ago, he had that horrible crisis on his hands.
The war hadn't actually started when he was inaugurated. And I understand that he made the statement that if there was going to be a war, the South would have to fire the first shot.
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
He did tell him in his first inaugural address that he says, in your hands and not mine lie the threat of civil war. He says, we will not assail you. But this, I believe this is very important. Just a few weeks later, everyone is watching to see what he's going to do. And it was the focus. What had happened in the South is they seceded. They also took over the forts and arsenals that belonged to the federal government. It was treason. It was rebellion. And the focus now was on Fort Sumter because there happened to be, even though he was a Kentucky man, a Southerner, his name was Major Robert Anderson, and only 60 soldiers at Fort Sumter.
And these were federal soldiers.
These were federal soldiers. And so the big battleground is, so what's Lincoln going to do? They're surrounded by several hundred cannons around Charleston Harbor, all pointed to Fort Sumter. And Lincoln's chief of staff, Winfield Scott, says, you got to let it go. You got to let it go. And most of his cabinet said, you got to let it go. And he said, go back and talk it over some more. Three times he told them to go back and talk it over. And they all came back with the same conclusion. Lincoln knew if they continued to give compromises, we would lose the South. And he knew by allowing the South to secede, we would lose our Constitution. Because shortly after the South had formed, states in the South wanted to secede from the Confederacy. We would have ended up with a continent like Europe, a bunch of different nations, all different constitutions. And he knew that we needed a strong, unified nation to protect the Constitution that our founding fathers gave us. He knew he could not continue to compromise. So this is what happened. He sends a letter, and note the date. This is on April 6th, 1861, which is a very significant day for Latter-day Saints. And this is essentially his first move, letting them know what he's going to do. And he sends a letter to the governor of South Carolina, which no longer has the American flag flying. They're the nation of South Carolina. And he says, I'm sending a ship down to Fort Sumter with food and supplies. There's no ammunition. There are no guns. There are no soldiers. I'm just going to essentially the message was, if you're going to fire on this ship, you're going to fire on food. It was extremely wise on the part of Lincoln. Because when that did go down, he was sending the message, no, you're not going to take any more of federal property, and you're not going to take any more that belongs to the federal government. And when that ship entered the harbor, that's exactly what happened. They fired a cannon over the bow of the ship, and the ship turned around out to sea and went away. And shortly after that, they started bombing Fort Sumter. So they did fire the first shot, and they fired on Fort Sumter. Some 3,000 rounds, cannons went in that. It's a thick walls, but not one of those 60 men were killed. It's pretty amazing. Let me just say go four more years. The very last major battle was begun on what date, do you think?
April 6th,
1865. It was exactly 4 years. Lincoln would tell you and said many times that God was behind this war. He said that the Civil War was a chastisement for the sins of the American people.
We talked a little bit about Abraham Lincoln's campaign issues being very similar to Joseph Smith's. I want to back up a little bit to that because I think that through the course of that war, there was some changes in his thoughts about slavery and abolition. I think at the very beginning of the war, his whole focus, and it stayed that way throughout the war, was preserve the Union, preserve the Constitution. We have to keep that together. But how did his views of slavery kind of change? Because he did have to – there were still two slave states that were part – that did not secede. They were still part of the Union, and he had to be careful with them.
He was very, very concerned about those border states that did not go to the South, and they were just looking for anything that they didn't agree with, and they would have joined the South. And Lincoln knew that that would be devastating to the Union, and so he was very careful about that. But he actually said in his first inaugural address, which really angered a lot of Republicans, He said, I have no intention of interfering with the institution of slavery while I'm present. He says, you know my personal views on the matter, but I don't feel I have any right or authority to change it. And he said that because our Constitution allowed for slavery. And he said this many times, that our founding fathers, even though many of them were not in favor of slavery, they had to make a compromise, and it allowed for it. And so he honored the Constitution so much. So all these years he had been talking against slavery. He becomes president and he says, I have no intention of interfering with slavery. I'm going to preserve the Union. Just like you said, that was his primary objective. But an interesting thing happened. When he said, I believe I have no authority to do it, you know that's what Lincoln believed. Because he was just that kind of honest man. There was never any double talk or double speak with Lincoln. It was always very straightforward. A year and a half into the war, the Union is losing the war. They're really in trouble. And Lincoln realizes sometime in that time that as President of the United States, in a time of war, as Commander-in-Chief, he has a right to confiscate property if it will be for the benefit of the nation. Now, I'm paraphrasing. All those decades before, our pro-slavery states and Congress, which had through these years from the beginning, were very heavy-sided on pro-slavery candidate, but senators and congressmen had written what they called black laws. And they were laws which said that, number one, that the black man and woman and child are property. They're not persons. It was written in the books, you pay taxes on property. You can sell property. You can whip property. And slaves were property. Well, Lincoln now realizes he can now legally confiscate property, and he needed soldiers. Many people in the North said, free the slaves, but they'll never be good soldiers. And Lincoln says, I believe they'll be as good as any other. And so that's when he had prayed for a long time about what to do. And the thing that was holding him back were these border states, like you pointed out. If he moves at the wrong time, he may lose these border states. Well, the time finally came. He actually prayed to God. He'll tell you this. We have it in the records. He said, I think I'm ready now to free the slaves, but I need some kind of message from you that it's the right time. And he says, if we can win this next battle, which is Gettysburg, I will take that as a message from you that I can now move forward with this.
And Gettysburg was a miracle.
Yes, it was. It was. There were a lot of miracles in that time. So to the surprise of his cabinet shortly after that battle, because they had been debating this for months and were split. Half of them wanted to, half of them says you can't. Lincoln walked in one day and says, I am now ready to free the slaves. And they were stunned. That hadn't been, they'd kind of been tabled for some time. And they said, well, why are you saying this now? And his response to this, and it's in the journals of at least two of the cabinet members, he said, God has ruled in favor of the slave. He says, I am not here to debate it anymore. I've made my decision. I need your help in writing the proclamation. And that's how he changed, just like you said, because he promised not to interfere. And then he does interfere in such a way that he frees the slaves. And as we know, the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves just in the rebelling states. Some people have criticized him for that, but it's the smartest thing anyone could have done. Had he freed them all, he would have lost the border states again. Mm-hmm. And he was so wise in the way he handled it. And then for the next 2 years, he works feverishly to pass the 13th Amendment, which he did pass, which said there will be no more slavery anywhere on America at any time. And he ended slavery, and it passed. So he did finish the process, but he was smart enough to do it in those steps.
How did Mr. Lincoln view his own role and his destiny during this conflict?
Lincoln believed that he was called of God. And he said it many times. He's just 2 weeks prior to the election as president. He is with the superintendent of schools for Illinois. His name is Newton Bateman. And they would do these straw polls just like we do now. Who you plan on voting for? And he had it for just the local Springfield people. He was really troubled that there were of the 23 ministers who had submitted their straw vote, 20 of them were voting for Stephen A. Douglas and only 3 for Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln knew the reason why. It was back to the religious issue again, that he would never join any church. And it troubled him. He says, here are these religious men that are willing to vote for the pro-slavery candidate. And Newton Bateman says, it's a very detailed account. He says Lincoln started walking back and forth and tears were streaming down his eyes. And he made a statement. I'm kind of looking for it here, but I'll just paraphrase it. He says, I know there is a God and that he hates injustice and slavery. If he has a place for me, and I think he has, then I believe I'm ready. With his help, I cannot fail. And then he goes on to say, and he says, and then those ministers will see that they have not read their Bibles right. And from that point on, when he's elected, he speaks in front of a group in New Jersey and other places, and he said, I'm here by the vote of the people and by the hand of the Almighty God. And numerous other times, he would often refer himself to a humble instrument in the hands of God. And so when you say, how did he view himself? He truly did view himself as a servant of God, trying. And numerous times he said, once I know what God's will is, that's what I'll do. But I need to know what God's will is. There was one time, a few weeks before he freed the slaves, a group of ministers came to him. And his door was always open for people to come in. Every day he would just talk to anyone and hear them out. But he got to where he dreaded the ministers because they would all, I know it's God's will that you do this. And it was hardest. Those were the hardest for him. And this group came in and they told him again that God wills that you free the slaves and do it now. And again, I'm paraphrasing, but he looked at me and says, please don't be offended. He said, but if God has a will regarding slavery, why would he reveal it to you and not to me, where I'm so directly involved in this? It kind of tells you he was looking for some kind of message or revelation from God. And there are other instances as well that may give you that impression. Let me jump to the end of the Civil War. He's in the Lee has surrendered to General Grant and Jefferson Davis and the Confederate government in Richmond, Virginia, are on their way. They're fleeing Richmond. They've left their capital. Lincoln is nearby. He's in General Grant's camp. And when he hears that they've left Richmond, he takes his 12-year-old son, Tad, and a small group of soldiers, only about 20 of them is all, protecting him. He goes into Richmond. And he's walking through these burned-out streets because when the Confederates left, they lit their warehouse on fire of arms. And a wind came up and burned over half the city. It's just a smoldering mess. And he's walking through. He's tall. He's got a stovepipe hat on. He's very somber. And a group of African slaves, African-American slaves, see him. And there's their father, Abraham, their savior. And they run up to him. And that's what they call him, those different names. They run up to him. And one of them bows down at his feet. And Lincoln immediately stands him up and he says, oh, no. He says, you don't bow to me. He said, God has given you your freedom. I have been but his humble instrument. So it's very clear that Lincoln viewed his role as a servant of God.
I thought what was interesting is you pointed out also in some of your material that he called for national days of fasting.
He did. He sent 11 proclamations to America during the Civil War, 11 of them. Many of them were following major battles or events. 11 of them called for days of fasting and prayer. And in those days of where he called people to fasting and prayer, he's calling America to repentance various times in those proclamations. He says, this war goes on because of the nation's sins. He says, we have forgotten God in another one. And I can quote you numerous others. I don't have them in front of me, but numerous times in those proclamations, he called America to repentance.
Now, we know that President Lincoln was assassinated. And I guess we could probably say that he sealed his testimony with his blood. How devastating was that assassination? Because I know that he had his agenda for how he was going to deal with the southern states, but something completely different happened. So how devastating was his assassination?
Let me go back to his reelection, which is just a few weeks prior to his assassination. Lincoln did not campaign that second year. He said nothing in defense of himself. He said if the people want someone else, then that's who they should have. They voted overwhelmingly to keep him in office. But he for a year lobbied that we will not hunt down these leaders and these generals. They will go to their homes. We will invite the southern senators and congressmen back to Congress. And he spoke it for so long that when he was assassinated, his cabinet and many in Congress took that track of compassion and reconciliation, not near as strong as it would have been had Lincoln still been alive. But James Wilkes Booth thought he was doing the South a great favor, but he had taken the only real friend that they had. It was a tragic thing. But I love the fact that you would refer to him sealing his testimony as blood. He believed that God needed another sacrifice. Now, he knew a man by the name of Charles Chiniquy. He was a Catholic minister, a very successful one. He'd draw crowds in the thousands. And one night he was from Canada, Eastern Canada. He gave us a message one time, a sermon. And after the message, he said, and he went home, he received these words came into his mind. He says, "Father Chiniquy, you are teaching a lie." He was teaching about how Mary makes intercession to Jesus for us. "You're teaching a lie." Well, he studied the scriptures and came to the conclusion that that was not as the Bible directed. And he was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And the Catholics, he claims, they continued to go after him. And he was in a legal case where Lincoln represented him. They became friends. And Chiniquy came to the White House three different times during Lincoln's presidency to tell him, "There are people that are trying to take your life." And Lincoln just simply says, "You know, I know that they are trying. I've hear those reports all of the time." But he says, "I see no other recourse," and I'm paraphrasing, but he used this term, "other than to always be ready to die." That was his term, to always be ready to die. And he says, "I've been reading this passage in Deuteronomy where he talks about how Moses," I hope I'm giving the right book of the Bible, but it's where Moses is at the River Jordan and God says, "The others can go over, but you can't, Moses." And it says God was angry, and Lincoln says as he read it, God was angry at Moses for the sins of the people. And essentially, he says, "I haven't been able to get this out of my mind for the last 5 weeks, that God had to have one more sacrifice, and it was the most righteous one of the Israelites. It was Moses. All the others could pass over, but Moses could not." And he says, "I can't get out of my mind the magnitude of Moses' sacrifice to not be allowed to go over." And then he says, then compare that to the Savior's sacrifice for all of the world. He says, and he uses this term, "I am mute in my adoration of the sacrifice of the Savior." And then he tells the Charles Chiniquy, he says, "I can't get out of my mind the thought that God needs one more sacrifice and that I am that sacrifice." And he says, "So it matters not to me whether it's a dagger's knife or a bullet or whatever. When it's time to die, I just hope that I will die without any murmuring." And he says, "And what an honor it will be to stand with Moses and the Savior of giving my life for my beloved country." So he believed that he would die for his cause.
And I understand he even had a dream.
Yes, he did. It was only about 2 weeks before he was assassinated. And in that dream, he's sleeping, and he wakes up in the middle of the night, and he hears wailing and crying. And it's dark in the White House, and he says, "So in my dream, I'm going from room to room trying to find the source of the crying. And finally, I work my way to the east room. I break open the doors, and I see a room full of people, and I see a casket. And I go up to the soldier, and I say, 'Who is dead in the White House?' And the soldier says, 'The president is dead.'" And then he says, "And then I woke up." The thing that's interesting about that story, two things. it makes such an impression on him that he feels like he needs to tell Mary. And again, this is only a couple weeks before he is assassinated. And he has Mary and two or three other people in the room where he tells that story. And Mary just thinks it's horrible. She says, oh, that's terrible to even think of that. But he says, well, he says, it's probably nothing, but I felt I needed to tell you. And then the thing that's very significant, I believe, he goes on to say, after I had that dream, I went back to my room and opened the scriptures. And I open the scriptures and my eyes fall right on God giving vision to someone. It was Jacob, the prophet Jacob. And then I flip over and I see another instance where God is giving a vision or revelation to someone else. I flip it again and there's another one. And I flip it again and there's another one. And he took that as confirmation that this dream that he had just had was more than a dream. And that is exactly what happened when he died. His casket was in the East Room, and that's where they held his funeral. Let me just tell you about Lincoln's final day on Earth. He's assassinated on Good Friday. And whether that means anything or not, I really don't know. But there are some really significant dates here for the Latter-day Saints. His first act with the war is April 6th, and the last major battle is April 6th, and he is assassinated on April 9th, Good Friday. But that day, his oldest son, Robert, had just come home, and he was a lieutenant under General Grant, and he was present at Appomattox where Lee and Grant signed their surrender agreement. He was on the porch outside, and so he was telling his father that morning, that Friday morning, about the events. And Abraham Lincoln was just buoyant. And they're talking about his future career plans. And he goes to his, which turned out to be his last cabinet meeting. And everyone there is saying, we've never seen the president so cheerful and so upbeat and so clear in his thinking and his voice and his utterances and such. And it was the whole day that way. And often in the afternoons, Abraham Lincoln and Mary would go on carriage rides, but always with someone else, and they'd talk business or the war or the governing of the nation. And Mary, he said to her, Mary, we'll have our carriage ride. And she said, and who will be with us today? And he says, oh, no, today I'll ride with you. It'll just be the two of us. And so they had a wonderful 2 hours where they reminisced their lives, their little Willie still, or excuse me, Edward married back and buried in Springfield, and their happy years there. And he says, we've got to be more cheerful. We've been very, very miserable here in these 4 years in the White House during the war. And it was hard on their marriage. It was just very hard. Their whole lives was a difficult thing. But they have this wonderful day together, and Mary says the same thing. She says, my dear husband, I don't know when I've seen you so cheerful. And why is it? And he says, it's because this day I finally consider that the war is over. So it's on the day when he finally believes that the war, his mission is complete, that he seals his testimony, if we call it that, with his own blood. And later that night they go to Ford's Theater, and his bodyguard was ready to go with him. And Lincoln says, no. He says, you've worked a long day. You don't need to go. And he says, oh, but I'm willing to go. I want to go. And Lincoln insisted that he not go. And it's interesting, as he's standing there at the steps of the White House, kind of stunned, what do I do? He just told me not to come. Lincoln starts walking toward the carriage and then turns around and looks at him, and he says, goodbye. There's just this final goodbye. And then off to the Ford's Theater, and a couple hours later, James Wilkes Booth puts a gun from about 2.5 feet behind him and assassinates him. That's the end of his life.
I think it was Secretary Stanton when President Lincoln finally drew his last breath and was pronounced dead. What was it that he said?
He took his hat and he lifted it up off his head high, brought it down, and then back up again, and he said, now he belongs to the ages. Those were his words. Can I tell you about Stanton, the relationship that they had with him? back before he became president. This is about 4 or 5 years before he became president. Edwin Stanton was one of the more powerful attorneys in America. And there was this big legal case with the McCormick Reaper farm machinery case. And they needed some local lawyers to help as these Eastern lawyers came out to Cincinnati to hold the trial. Stanton was one of them. He was the lead one. They had asked one local attorney, but he couldn't make it. So someone says, what about Abraham Lincoln? And they say, okay. So Lincoln does all this research, gets on stagecoaches and trains and gets his way to Cincinnati. And when he gets there, again, he's kind of not dressed very well, didn't worry about his appearance. And sometimes they say his pants were up. You could see his ankles. I mean, they were way too high for his long legs. And Stanton just looked at him and said, I don't want him on this team. And in fact, and so this group of lawyers just has their meetings, but they never invite Lincoln. But no one will tell him that they don't want him there. And as Lincoln is just kind of nearby, he hears Stanton say, I don't want that long-armed gorilla on our team. What can he do for us? Lincoln overheard that. And, you know, I've told you how he just never – he always forgave. He'd often say, I believe in having a short statute of limitations, meaning that he'd forgive anyone immediately, and he always did. So he just quietly – at the right time, handed over his research, and he says, I'll just go ahead and return to Springfield. But before he returned, he stayed for the case. And he watched Edwin Stanton and these others practice law like nothing he'd seen in Illinois. They were much more skilled and more trained. And he was so impressed with it. Well, imagine Edwin Stanton's surprise when 4 years later, Stanton was a Republican, and his Republican candidate is his long-armed gorilla that he rejected. And then the president of the United States is the same one that he rejected. And then to his utter amazement, after Lincoln's original Secretary of War had to be released because he was doing some unethical things, and Lincoln, to protect him, sent him off to be the ambassador to Russia, which he willingly accepted to get out of the country, Lincoln sends a letter to Edwin Stanton and asks him to be his Secretary of War. Which is absolutely remarkable. Lincoln did not fear anyone. He knew what Stanton, he remembered what Stanton had said about him, but the personal things didn't matter to him. He needed someone who was strong and smart to run the war. And of all the people in America, his thoughts went to Edwin Stanton. And if he thought he was the best man, he didn't care about the other things. And Stanton would come into the cabinet, and he would disagree with Lincoln. There was one time where Lincoln had asked him to do something, and Stanton says, I won't do it. It's wrong. And so Stanton's going on this tirade of why he shouldn't do it. And Lincoln very calmly says, but I think we should still do it, Secretary Stanton. And then he goes on again, and he argues more. And finally, calmly, Lincoln just said, Secretary Stanton, it must be done. And he did it. He was not intimidated. And it's just so remarkable. And Stanton, as you pointed out, came to admire Abraham Lincoln to such a high level that, in fact, Robert Lincoln, Lincoln's oldest son, tells a story that for days after Lincoln's assassination, Edwin Stanton would be at his door every morning with his hat in his hand and in tears, asking if he could come in and talk about his friend Lincoln.
When we look at the legacy of President Lincoln, this drive that he had and that he finished, that he completed, of preserving the Union of the United States of America and abolishing slavery on this continent, within this country, what impact does that have for me today? And not just me here in the United States, but what impact did that have beyond the borders of the United States to other people in other countries?
Well, that's a really important point, I think. Dallin H. Oaks has made the comment that it is a miracle that we would have this Constitution. It's a miracle that it even happened. And as you read that, you can see that that's probably very, very true when you look into what the circumstances of us having the Constitution. Then you have Abraham Lincoln saying in the middle of the war, He says, made this statement, and he referred to our government as an experiment. George Washington referred to it as an experiment. He says, this government's been called an experiment. He says, 2 points in it our people have already proven or settled. One is, could it be successfully established? Well, yes. Our founding fathers established this government. Two, could it be administered? He says, we've accomplished that too. Well, there have been challenges and problems along the way, but we have administered this Constitution. The third one, can it be maintained? He says, we are in the midst of proving that question today. And this is true. We nearly lost the Constitution. The Confederacy took our Constitution. They boasted that, well, we're using the same Constitution. We've just changed a few things. Well, for one, they got rid of the statement in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Lincoln was always using that point in his speeches. The South didn't want any part of that. Stephen A. Douglas and many, many, many others would say, this government was formed for the white people and for no one else. Other races are not equal with white people. We are superior in this government. God has given us just for us and not for the others. And so they changed other things. Instead, one simple word, instead of we the people, which is the foundation of our Constitution, then they said we the deputies. And once again, the government is the hand of the powerful. It would have, Lincoln says, would have destroyed our Constitution. And I'm so grateful for Ted and Chris Stewart and their book, The Seven Miracles That Saved America. When they speak about Lincoln, Ted and Chris cover that element so beautifully and so clearly that we nearly lost this Constitution. And Lincoln knew it clear back in 1854 when Stephen A. Douglas passed that Kansas-Nebraska Act saying that people now could just vote for slavery. He knew that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. And so he, on his own, takes on America and wins. It's the most remarkable thing. I don't know of anyone doing anything so powerful except men who were led and guided by God. I don't know of a man who could do what he did.
And what's so interesting is that at that time, the United States was the only country with a constitution.
That's right. Go ahead.
And now there are many countries that have their own constitutions.
Dallin H. Oaks, I started to refer to his reference when he said it was a miracle. And he says, every nation except six have some form of a constitution. Your question is such an important one. What's the legacy of what Lincoln preserved for us? And that is this, that there's democracy and religious freedom and freedom to assemble and freedom of speech in most countries in America, and it's because they have constitutions patterned after ours. It was remarkable, and we nearly lost it in the 1860s. Abraham Lincoln, as God's humble instrument, through God's direction, preserved it for us.
The Battle of Gettysburg, we talked earlier, was a watershed in the war. It was the turning event. Several weeks after that war, and there were, 50,000 who participated in that war? What were the casualties like?
Oh, it was over 50,000 when you got both sides. It was over 50,000.
Casualties.
Yeah.
And so they dedicated a cemetery there at Gettysburg, and President Lincoln was invited to come and address the nation. There was a speaker before him that spoke for 2 hours. And we'd like to finish up today and have you read for us the Gettysburg Address.
I would love to. Let me just say, when Lincoln gave his speech after Edward Everett gave his 2.5-hour speech, it was a good speech, and Edward was a respected man. But Everett looked at Lincoln's Secretary of State, and they says, that wasn't a very good speech. Everett says it won't go very far. And Seward said the same thing. And Lincoln, after his speech, he went to his aide and he said, I'm telling you, that speech won't scour. That's the term he used. He said, it's not going to hold. Well, all three of them were wrong, because the Gettysburg Address, as you say, has been just memorialized ever since the event. Here's what he said. It's very short. In fact, It was so short, there was a photographer there setting up his camera, and he didn't get his the picture taken in time. The only picture he's got is Lincoln is sitting down.
Yeah.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us here to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, and by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Thank you. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. I'm Marilee Stallings.